book moves chronologically from childhood through old age, basically, and it's called Geography of Home, and it's concerned and interested in all the places, physical and emotional, that I've called home over the years. And I like to start with a poem. If you're of a certain age, and that's such a wonderful euphemism, isn't it? It means if you're old, you will know who Dick and Jane are, were. Many of us were learned to read by reading these readers in elementary school, that the main characters were named Dick and Jane. They were brothers and sister. And we followed their exploits through the years learning to read. They had a cat named Puff, a dog named Spot, a stay-at-home mom, a dad who was some kind of business guy who went off every day. They were white, they were middle class, they were suburban. They were unlike anybody I knew. And so this poem is called Dick and Jane, and I think it'll tell you how I feel about them. Oh, how I hated their precious pets and perfect parents, their goody two-shoed lives balanced on the footbridge of white bread and moral smugness. But they taught me to read, taught me to live. And then they vanished from the public eye in 1965, aged 10 and 8. They'd be in their late 50s, early 60s by now, and I hope it was a rocky ride of rehab and therapy. But it wasn't really. Jane's first marriage was short and terrible, but her second was happy. She's a retired nurse practitioner with three loving grandchildren. Dick still works as an insurance adjuster and is a closeted member of the school board. Isn't it funny how in some ways we were never children, and in other ways we always are? But they taught me to read. They taught me to see. See the weary light on the lawn of late summer. See the years rise like ash into a starless sky. See Spot run. Please don't clap. Just wait until the end. If you don't clap, then I'll feel bad. As Katie knows, my nose runs. I'm going to give her eating something. Excuse me. This poem is called October Years. One Halloween night, a ghost chased me and my younger brother across the overgrown field between our house and the derelict Victorian down the road. We crashed into our kitchen hysterical, where our mother washed dishes, where our father read the sports section, at that table of so many awkward meals, and the dog jumped up in alarm. I later found the sheet with the cutout eye holes folded on the cellar stairs. I never told my brother. My father, a real ghost now, resides on the phone that doesn't ring on Sunday nights, on the Weather Channel, on the back stoop of a silent house I'll never see again. Old ghost, what can you tell me in late October when the demons come knocking dressed as children? So some of these poems are about actual places I lived as a young man, especially. And this one I'm going to dedicate to Amy and Andrew. It begins with a quote from the band Little Queenie and the Percolators, and the quote is, "My darlin' Nollins." And it's called, "How stable the city of God, how disordered the city of man." The year of my first city, when the Neville brothers were the bar band at Tipitina's. The year the wild Tropituas tribe descended on St. Joseph's Day, a firebomb of feathers and blue sequins. The year spent 2 weeks at a time on a towboat and 1 week of mischief at a time in the quarter. Is the Outran Salon still there, or has it vanished like a memory of a bad memory? The year the river ran like Danube fever through the blood of Magazine Street. The year of dancing madly to the ancient drums in the turmoil of Congo Square. The year of the girls from the Desire Street Project with their golden wisdom teeth. The year of voodoo and zydeco and heat lightning lasered against the trembling night. The year the Night Tripper played his broken squeeze box for all those troubled ghosts outside the Napoleon House. The year they dusted off Professor Longhair from his janitor job in a warehouse in the Irish Channel and propped him back up at his piano. And the year they released his lost sessions, not lost, misplaced, merely an answer to how love is revealed. At the time I lived in New Orleans, I worked for almost a year on a towboat, pushing barges in the New Orleans Harbor and sometimes up and down the Mississippi. And many times your work is also your home, and in this case it was literally my home because we lived on that thing for 14 days on and then 7 days off. So this is called work. We worked the front watch, catching the sodden lines tossed from the dock and weaving them through the bow cleats next to the pilot house before moving upstream to center the capstan line on the waiting tow. We tightened the tow with face wires and wing wires, coiled steel cables hauled up from below the Texas deck, working the skiffs with 6-foot ratchets and tying the eyes in the lock lines while the twin screws swing the boat starboard toward the sun. "Hold on, boys," the captain crackles over the intercom. "Hold on," as we buck through the wake of an Iberian freighter, blooming black smoke and rust. I grasp the port side bushing on the head deck in my blown out work boots, cutoffs, and frayed oversized life vest hanging uselessly from my skinny sunburned shoulders. The water clears and I see the river spreading out on both sides of the heavy southern Louisiana morning, all silver and blue and sweet May green. And though I don't know it yet, this moment, this time, will blister and burn most of the rest of my days. So I'm just gonna pick through some more poems in this. Second section concerns itself with some larger poems that are concerned with my other home, and that is the home of books and authors, and also of history. And the poem I'd like to read first is called Rebellion Weather. It's in two parts. And the first part, we kind of take a contemporary walk through Dublin, sort of retracing Joyce's steps in Ulysses. The second part is more concerned with Yeats and the countryside. And they're both also informed by the two rebellions in Ireland of 1916 and 1921. Rebellion Weather. One, Dublin. Above the harbor of Howth, the early morning transatlantic flights, trailing Arctic vapor, descend over the Portumont links along the Velvet Strand and Ireland's Eye, the island of hope and barnacles toward Dublin International. Listen to the soft heave of the Irish Sea, Joyce's gray sweet mother, its thud and return as it roils in all the way from Holyhead. The Dart to Abbey Street station begins a walk through Dublin, not June 16th, 1904, but still the whiffs of ginger, tea dust, biscuit mush linger among the shops and crowds on Grafton. Self-exiled in Zurich, Joyce missed the English gunboats of 1916, moored in the Liffey, Sackville Street burned to the ground in front of the shattered post office, that cathedral of noble intentions gone terribly wrong. And the 14 leaders executed in Calamangal, Connolly was so badly wounded he couldn't stand, so they shot him strapped to a chair. At 4 o'clock, when the shooting was done, a gentle rain began to fall, the tears of dark Rosaline on that death-hunting day. You can still buy a bar of soap in Sweeney's Apathy and order a cheese sandwich and a glass of Burgundy and David Brin's, then walk on through the late afternoon past the cricket fields of Trinity, the once-hated Georgian apartments in St. Stephen's Green, with its history of public whippings and hangings. And later at the Stag's Head or John Mulligan's in Temple Bar, lingo of a pint of stout. There's a memory of a memory here, the smells of men spat on sawdust, Swedish warmish cigarette smoke, the stale ferment. Evening lingers where God is a shout in the street, music skills spills from light into shadows of shadows, Bachelor's Walk, Halfpenny Bridge, Lamb Alley, Merchant's Crown, Alley Arch, Wellington Quay, and Molly's Song. And yes, I said yes, I will, yes. And much later, the Dublin sky journeys back from hazy gold to purple to black. The summer evening has begun to fold. the world in its mysterious embrace. And we return where we began, out past Dublin Bay, that ancient estuary, where it is all quiet on Hoth now. 2, beyond the pale. Yes, the internet was right. Rain is general all over Ireland. The mean, hard rain of Derry, the sweet curtains of rain opening over Tullamore, the rain that obscures the unfinished housing estates of Galway, the rain sliding off Tuba, Inois, Yates's Tower outside Gort, all millboards and sea-green slates, the rain that sends Ishmore, Ishaman, and Ishir drifting into the North Atlantic, and then the sideways rain above the uneven tides of the Donegal coast, the rain over the weedy field next to the abandoned petrol station, littered with the colorful and dangerous caravans of the travelers, the ancient, watchful rain of Bur na Bani, the eternal rain of the bog and the pasture and the domain and the tin roof and the stone street and the steady rain on a graveyard in Drumcliff, Benbulben looming to the north. Cast a cold eye on life, on death, horsemen pass by. Rain, Bashtek, house of baptism, rain, what is past or passing or to come. On a hill above the harbor outside Teelin, crouched the ruins of a burned out Coast Guard station destroyed during a gun battle with the IRA on the morning of June 17, 1921. Patrick Kensington was shot dead, and so ended the rebellion weather of that northern offense. In the wind above the harbor, you can almost hear scraps of the songs of the field. He shall not hear the bitter and cry in the wild sky where he is lain, nor voices of the sweeter birds above the wailing of the rain. And again, Yeats, may these carriages remain when all is ruined once again. And then up on Slieve League, towering over the coast, where dolphins played down below in the cliff's backwash, and at dusk the ghosts of the coffin ships ply their way, creaking west across the North Atlantic toward the famine-free world, leaving the mainland in their long gray wakes. Ireland, the interrupted, half-remembered dream, the memory of a memory, the shadow of a shadow. Next two poems are concerned with writers as well, and they're historical in nature, but I think that they're also concerned with things we're still haunted by. Who are we as a people, as a nation? How do we deal with immigration? How do we deal with race? And the first of the two I'm going to read is called Dispatches, the Chicago Race Riots, 1919. And I think it'd be interesting to hear the byline of the young reporter who's responsible for these dispatches. It begins with a quote from the Reverend W.C. Thompson of the Pentecostal Church, 34th and South State Street, Chicago, Illinois. New things is coming, altogether diverse from what they has been. 1, the facts. The Red Summer began on Sunday, July 27th, off the 25th Street beach when a colored child swam across an imaginary segregation line. White boys threw rocks, knocked him off his raft, and he drowned. The white police did nothing. The toll by August 3rd was 23 Negroes dead, 15 whites, and scores of houses burned. 6,000 colored union men walked off the yards, and the packing plants dropped to 60% capacity, lowering production and lessening the amount of commodities for the market. Swift and Armour went to the Stockyards Labor Council, and the union said their men, white and colored, would stand together, equal and organized and opposed to violence. Production stabilized based on a poisonous lie. And here's where the Irish are not considered so romantic. 2, the truth. The black belt of southern Negro migration, people just looking for a chance among the bleached angels of the north, grew too tight around the Irish south side, Bridgeport behind the yards, and caused an explosion poising one poor population against another, ignited by Irish gangs, thugs from the Irish Hamburg Athletic Club, always looking for trouble with semi-white immigrants, Jews, Chinese, Poles, Greeks, Italians, Mexicans, but especially the blacks. The people hold to the humdrum of work and food while reaching out. This reaching is alive. And so the bodegas, chop suey joints, poker and crap parlors try your wrist, barbecue stands, luncheonettes of Italian beef and fried bologna, taverns of sawdust and spit, cowboy bars with their steel string sounds of Abilene and Tucumcari, blues bars as dark as the Delta, and the jazz clubs whose horns percolate up from Basin Street to East St. Louis to this long stretch of South State Street, all lean together in an easy alliance, never far from the great lowering of the Union Stockyard and Transit Company, from the bubbling stench of the South Fork of the Chicago River. The load of shorthorns splintering the boards, oh Lord, the shorthorns. The Chicago Central and the Illinois Central and the Michigan Central roll in the steers and sheep and hogs of Montana, Nebraska, and Iowa all day and night, while the Canadian Grand Trunk Railroad moves 450,000 tons of ice a week. The wheel of death takes 35 minutes to kill and dress a steer, an assembly line of death where black men, only black men, known as beef luggers, stagger through blood and time and barely a living wage, carrying on their shoulders whole quarters of slaughtered beef. Of the 20 looking on, 10 murmur, oh, it's a hell of a job. 10 others, Jesus, I wish I had the job. Nothing is lost. At the end of the line, the hair factory at 44th and Ashland Ave churns out leather, soap, glue, ivory, shoe polish, buttons, perfume, combs, and violin strings. The endless disassembly line of after death that nothing can stop. The unions say the riots were not about race, but about equal pay, housing, and education, issues they can fix, but they can't because the riots were about race. What do you do when every time you build a sandcastle, someone kicks it down? You build it over a cinder block. The boy who drowned off the 25th Street beach, his name was Eugene Williams. He was 13 years old. In the darkness with a great bundle of grief, the people march. In the night and overhead, a shovel of stars for keeps, the people march. Carl Sandburg, the Chicago Daily News, November 1919. Okay, just a couple more. So my friends, Helen and Phil Fisher. And this is very self-explanatory. It's called My Willa Cather. I followed you along the dusty, sunflower-edged roads of Nebraska, between the Platte River and Kansas, all leather flower, aster, and evening primrose, where the horizon was like a perfect circle, a great embrace. I visited your childhood home in Red Cloud and stood in the doorway of your attic room, its single bed, its peeling rose-flecked wallpaper, and did not enter. Outside, past the vast loneliness of the prairie, I felt the old pull of the earth you wrote of so well, and those Sundays when all afternoon was full of quiet. I followed you over California Hill, where the ruts cut by 1,000 Conestoga wagons can still be seen, still moving along the Oregon Trail. And I followed you into the high desert, that far away nearby, where there is everything and nothing, Mesa Verde, Ghost Ranch, Santa Fe and its Mission Bell, the three sisters of the Navajo, squash, corn, and beans, blue mountains, sunlight of red dust, the twisted trunks of the old, old tamaris. O pioneer, I come back to you now, a century later, to find the outsider always looking in, the immigrant, so American, so at home, yet alone in this world. And I can't negate the fact or ignore the fact that the Midwest has been my home, at least for 9 months out of the year, for 35 years now. So this poem is called Central Standard Time. Tattooed against the shimmering horizon, the brakeman's yawn, the crop duster's cough, the grave digger's bad back, the tracks and trains and grain silos and watchful water towers of the known world, a cantina off the crossroads of US 41 and the Lincoln Highway, its kitchen radio tuned to La Movida 10:40 a.m., a ballad strummed on a Gibson Sunburst, in a sour cell block in Pendleton. Morning doves settle in the eaves of the L&M hotel that won't finally fall down. Rain against the dusty corn, the roof of a pickup, and a storm from nowhere disturbs this lonely universe, these fields of brown faces. Later, a radium wristwatch glows on a dark nightstand. Speak shadows, speak slow. Regressa a Indiana, no tardes, de mas sidato. Os que sieres vagabondo, para siempre. Adios, adios, a siempre, estará esperando. Gracias, Ashley y Maria. Where are you? Thanks for the Spanish lesson. All the way from El Salvador. And thank you for Dr. David Hitchcock, who translated that poem of Hart Crane's from English into Spanish. And the English goes like this, it's called Indiana. Come back to Indiana, it's not too late, or will you be a rover till the end? Goodbye, goodbye, oh, I shall always wait. Casey, what do you think?
You good.
Couple more?
Yeah, sure.
So I said that the book sort of ends toward old age, and this poem's called My Ginkgo, and it's dedicated to Richard Powers, probably one of one of our great living novelists. If you haven't read Overstory, read it. It's phenomenal. My Ginkgo. A funny word in English, in Japanese, ginkgo, silver apricot. More beautiful sounding there than here, but not as beautiful as my ginkgo. Not mine, really, but a stranger's I see every morning across the park. My ginkgo is 270 million years old, and I love its leaves, its little paper fans of time that say, we've been here before, we'll be here long after. Six ginkgos, 1.5 kilometers from the blast at Hiroshima, were the only living things to survive. How much longer, begs the grandchild from the back seat, as the shadows of branches scrape above the moving car. Only a little while now, we say, just a little while. Though, oh, how now my ginkgo's leaves are leaving, flat and yellow wet in this November rain. I'm back to the expression, a certain age. This poem is called After a Certain Age. After a Certain Age. You only look in a mirror to see a mirror. The world begins to fray along the edges, and you become invisible. You know many dead people, and there's no one left to blame for your long lane of troubles but yourself. You can finally afford to be kind, yet you sometimes prefer the bankruptcy of quiet meanness. You forget the definition of righteous fury. The big ship sinks and dies. The mission to Mars will not return. You become a scrivener of traffic and time. Tears are replaced with the boardroom of boredom and impatience. You can be assured a room without a view, a shore without a sea, a world without a home. Now, I didn't want to end on that poem, please. So I want to end on a really short poem that I think is very funny, and some people might think it's sacrilegious. I was thinking one day, what would it have been like? I've been a waiter lots of times in my life. And I was thinking, what would it be like to have been a waiter at one of the most important dinners in Christian history? I think you know where I'm going with this. But what I think makes it funny is that the waiter has no clue who he's waiting on or how important this dinner is. And there's one restaurant term in here, it's called 86. If the chef says 86 the special, that means we're out of it. 86 means we're out of something. So this is called The Last Supper. A waiter's nightmare. Half wanted appetizers, half soup. Three ordered the special with substitutions. One was allergic to nuts, one to dairy. They constantly demanded bread and only drank the cheap house wine. We had an 86 the lamb, and that caused some real hard feelings. Separate checks, of course. Two had gift certificates, seven had credit cards. The shifty-eyed guy split early, and I had to pick up his tab, 3 Grey Goose and tonics. And then that trouble with the cops later on. Christ, all for a lousy 10% before taxes. Thanks so much for coming.